Sure. I mean, as we talked about, the reality is, and there's lots of data to back this up, that we trust people more than we trust companies, full stop. And we certainly trust people who have real world experience with whatever product or service we're considering. And so your current customers are your best marketers. They just are, right? And so the more that you can turn customers into influencers, I think that's a fantastic approach for most B2B companies, right? Go find customers who are truly passionate and knowledgeable about your solution, and then help them get better known.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, and we're going to have a great discussion today because we have somebody who has a breadth and depth of experience that crosses over into the consumer world. And as we have seen as time has gone by, a little bit of convergence is happening, and we'll talk about how that evolution is or isn't happening because we have Jay Baer on the line. Jay, thanks for coming and joining us today.
What is up, Jim? Thanks for having me, B2B DM gang. Great to be with you. I've probably worked with many of you or interacted with many of you in certain circumstances, whether it's podcasts or blogs or conferences or somewhere else. So hope everybody's doing great out there.
Well, and talking about that background and experience, I mean, you've been creating content even from the time when you were in high school, which was a pretty incredible story on how you were influenced by that. And I even like the full circle story because when you were younger, you started with McDonald's and they were trying to get you to get into their management program. And
yeah,
it was not to do that because you listened to your mama, good boy. And then actually had full circle and actually presented to McDonald's and the corporate level. But before we go into, you know, our discussion today, and we're going to talk about the five silly things digital marketers do. If you can share a little bit about that background, I think that would be helpful as well.
Sure. I've been doing this so long that when I started in the internet business, the digital business, domain names were free. True story, my friends and I, my very first internet company, this is circa 1993. In those days, you could just get whatever domain names you wanted and just like have them. And we registered Budweiser.com amongst several others. And we got a call one day from Anheuser-Busch Brewing, now owned by InBev. And they said, we'd like to build the first ever website for Budweiser. And we'd like to have the domain name. And it says here that you young children, like I was 23 and the oldest partner at the time, you have the domain name and we'd like it back. And we said, well, we're not just going to give it to you. We're not fools like that. So we negotiated back and forth and back. We had lawyers draft contracts and the whole thing. And at the end of the day, Jim, we sold Budweiser.com to Anheuser-Busch in 1993 for 50 cases of beer. Now... In our defense, it was literally written into the contract, bottles, not cans, because, you know, you got to keep it classy. So the business has changed a little bit since then. I've been fortunate enough to consult with many of the largest companies in the world, including many huge B2B clients. I've done a lot of work with Cisco, with Oracle, with Salesforce, many in financial services as well. I am the founder of Convince and Convert, which is a global strategy firm and a popular blog and a series of podcasts as well. And I've written 6 best-selling books and spend most of my time doing market research and giving speeches now. So I travel around a lot and get to work with a lot of great B2B leaders, including just last month, I was the keynote at B2B MX in Scottsdale and may have seen some of you there.
Well, and, you know, and talking about that background and that longevity, I mean, going back to 1993, I mean, it's... imagining, you know, free domains back then and where yeah. we are now. I mean, that's
I've seen it all, literally.
Yes, you have. And so you oftentimes talking about dealing with all these different organizations of all these different sizes, you know, I'm sure the Q&A that you get from people, you're probably sometimes just smacking your head and saying, you know, that's just silly to think that way. That's just silly to do those things. And so we're going to actually focus in on 5 of those things that are most relevant in what we're finding today, because goodness knows, I saw this, and I'm sure you've seen it, and everybody else has experienced it, whether or not they noticed it to what degree is a different story. We were seeing changes that was happening, you know, 2015, 16, 17, and then COVID hit and just like 50X to all these changes.
Absolutely.
But still, we have a lot of B2B marketers that are doing 2010 and earlier, you know, practices and activities and thought processes. And that cannot continue if they want to survive. It's a survival thing now.
Well, it is how people find solutions and how people purchase solutions has changed so much. I mean, partially this idea, a lot of B2B companies come from a culture that's very sales led, and sales is of course an important part of the B2B success equation. But this idea that somehow sales and a salesperson is the process that every customer wants to go through and take a meeting and then a follow-up and then another one, it doesn't really hold water mathematically. In fact, Gartner says that you think about millennials and millennial customers are now in their 40s, right? These aren't kids, they're in their 40s. Millennials, approximately half of them would prefer an entirely seller-free process, meaning they never talked to a salesperson at all. One in two millennial buyers on B2Bs in the B2B world. So if they don't really want to deal with salespeople, who they want to deal with? Well, they want to self-serve all the information. They want to make their own decisions by consuming content either that you make or that they can get from trusted third parties. And so this idea that you've got to answer all the questions with the content is more important than it's ever been. I wrote a book called Utility many years ago, which became quite popular in the category about this idea of using content to sell. And even though that book's been out many years, I think it's just as vital and important today as it was then.
You know, you bring up a really interesting point talking about how we go about our decision-making process. And if you look at, there was a study that showed the top 10 list on how B2B decision makers actually go through and make their decisions. And the thing that has the most powerful impact of all, and it stands to reason if we stop to think about it, is the recommendations from their peers.
Sure.
They want to be in community with people who are going through some of the same struggles and say, hey, what are you doing? And that is never going to change. And if we stop and think about it and look at it in the consumer world, well, that's where the whole rating systems and grading systems and all of that feedback and it influences our decisions in regards to whether I buy or not.
I mean, fundamentally, information produced by the company trying to sell you something is the least trusted source, not the most trusted source. But you think about who is the author and creator of the vast majority of information about your product and service, it's you. And so consequently, everything you make has a little bit of a grain of salt, and in some cases, a bunch of salt to be taken with it. And that's why buyers rely on peers and third parties more so.
Well, we're also starting to see that go into, you had mentioned, you know, some of the statistics from some of these large consulting firms like Gartner, McKinsey, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. Even that, and those recommendations and those quadrants and whatever you want to, you know, whatever you want to talk about, those are tainted as well. Because a lot of people say, hey, we know this is a pay-to-play, you know, scenario. And so therefore, I want to go back to a little mm-hmm. bit more of a trusted source. And so with that being said, if we think about what that number one impact is, you talk about one of the silly things, then the first one that we're going to talk about is not creating enough content for your current customers. Yeah. Explain that a little bit.
We all know this to be true, that it is easier to keep the customers you've already earned and sell to them again than it is to go get a new customer out of thin air. Like, we all know this to be true. You learn this the first day in business. Yet, mysteriously, partially because people aren't typically bonused on retention, they're bonused on net new customer acquisition, we don't actually run businesses as if this were true. You think about all the content you create, all the marketing materials you create. Yes, increasingly B2B companies have a customer marketing department and somebody responsible for that, but it's usually a pittance compared to what's being created for the sales team and sort of for net new customer acquisition. And it's fundamentally misplaced. Right. If you ever lose a customer because they don't understand how to use the product or service, or they're not sure what the new features are, or they had trouble with implementation, that all can and should be fixed by you communicating to them better. So I would argue that we should spend less time trying to get new customers and more time making sure we keep the ones we've already gotten. And I know that makes sense to everybody, but yet when we get into our monthly or quarterly planning of the marketing activities we're going to conduct, it doesn't ever work that way for some reason. It's kind of mysterious.
Well, and okay, so that gets into this whole issue of us continuing to do the same silly things. So if you go on again, look in the statistics, and you have some that you're going to share here in a little bit. But if you look at top of funnel content in the B2B world, it's staggering as far as the amount of top of funnel content that is getting created. And it doesn't matter how good your stuff is. There's just a glut of information out there, and there's no way you're going to stand out by doing that. Going back to those decision factors, we know that if we focus in on our existing customers, that they're going to get tapped on the shoulder by one of their peers, and we need to be, in a position to where we're the ones that are top of mind when it comes to who do you use, why do you use them, and all of those, those stickiness elements. There's a closed loop on that. They are sticky, and they are going to recommend.
Yeah, I mean, if it feels like it was created for you and your circumstance, you're going to consume and believe and use that information disproportionately.
Most definitely. Okay, so I think that also leads into your number two recommendation. These two overlap and relate to one another. And you say not giving permission to tell a bigger story.
Yeah.
Explain that for us.
Well, you're right that most top of the funnel content fails because it's not inherently interesting. It's just broad and vague. What can work is top of the funnel content, which isn't about your product or service at all. I'll give an example. A year or so ago, I worked with ActiveCampaign, the marketing automation firm, on a program they launched, which was a Christmas recipe book from B2B marketing influencers. So I was in there, and Ann Handley and Mark Schaefer and Rand Fishkin and Neil Schaefer and a bunch of other folks in the community. And each of us contributed a photograph of a favorite holiday dish and a recipe. That had a grand total of 0% to do with marketing automation. None whatsoever. However, it was downloaded 300,000 times, was the most effective and successful marketing piece that they've ever executed, and contributed millions of dollars of pipeline. Now, the overwhelming majority of B2B marketing organizations would never do that. Why? Because it doesn't talk about the product. And I submit to you the reason it worked is that it didn't talk about the product. So when I say give yourself permission to tell a bigger story, understand that your customers, your personas, your ideal customer profiles, they have other interests in their life beyond buying your stuff. And if you can tap into those interests, sometimes that's the way to actually get them into your ecosystem.
Well, okay. So with you saying that, there's also some organizations that in the B2B world have really done an intentional strategy on downplaying their brand to increase their pipeline. But the traditional B2B sense is, hey, I need to build brand awareness. And if you can talk about that from a sales perspective, a lot of people in the sales world will complain and say, well, they don't know us. They don't know who we are. And what I tell them is that, you know what? Your brand does not matter until it matters, which is further down the decision-making process.
Precisely. Yeah. To me, people are going to look for solutions when they have a problem, and they're going to seek more around solutions providers. Where the brand starts to matter is the second step, is in the consideration phase. When the prospect is saying, okay, there are solutions to my problem available. There are approximately four organizations that can solve this problem, I think. Then they start to think about the brand comparisons between that set of four. But between then, people don't go out to say, I need to get myself some Oracle. They say, I have a problem. Oh, Oracle has a solution for this, right? So people don't buy brands, they buy solutions. So yes, brand is important. And I sympathize with sales folks who are trying to sell without a recognized brand, but it's not really an issue until the second stage of the consideration funnel.
Well, and I think that goes back into what we were saying with number one, not creating enough content for current customers. It definitely fits.
Yeah, no doubt.
Okay, so number three, it says B2B doesn't stand for boring to boring. And I think you gave one example of that, but if you could elaborate a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, the cookbook, the holiday recipe book is a good example, but ultimately what we tend to forget in B2B especially because B2B digital marketers flock together. This show is a great example. People tend to keep counsel from amongst the group of people who do similar occupations. And that's fine, makes sense. But the reality is your prospect is not only consuming content from B2B companies. They're consuming content from Yeti. They're consuming content from the Kardashians. They're consuming content from Pepsi and Audi and every other brand out there, most of whom are not B2B, they're B2C. And you think about how and where people consume content, it's oftentimes in places where B2B and B2C are alongside. And so it's not about, can you create an interesting piece of content or information that's sort of bold and dynamic in comparison to other credit unions or whatever industry you're in? Is it bold and dynamic, period, for people on the planet? And we have to understand that it doesn't matter if it's a social media algorithm or a direct mail piece or a webinar or a podcast episode or a conference. It doesn't matter what format it is. What matters is that it solicits a human emotion. If your content does not make people think, laugh, or get mad, it will fail, period. Unless it's super low content, low funnel content, where it's like, okay, my question is, what happens if the power's out? And then that answers the question. It's essentially an FAQ disguised as a video or whatever. Unless it's really low detail, low funnel detailed content like that, if it doesn't make people think, laugh, or get mad, it will fail, period. And that requires you to not be boring, right? You've got to actually do something that creates emotions. And that's hard for a lot of B2B organizations because they've sort of taken this vow that B2B stands for boring to boring, and their boss won't take any chances, and their boss's boss won't take any chances because they don't want to get fired. Well, the best way to get fired is to create a whole bunch of content for 5 years that doesn't work.
Well, with that being said, I think the last, you know, stat on CMO tenure is like 18 months.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons why we don't see chances, because people don't want to take chances when they only have 18 months. But I would argue the opposite should be the case. Look, man, if you've already got 18 months, like, roll the dice, like, do something cool.
And I know with do something cool, I mean, so you mentioned, you know, three emotional states. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot more than that.
Yeah.
In your experience, have you seen, you know, certain things essentially become more important as of late in regards to that emotional wheel? Hmm.
That's a good question. Well, I would say, I don't know if it's more important, but just sort of the tenor of how the world has progressed, content and productions that create some sense of anger or outrage tend to do really well now, because everybody's kind of on edge and everybody is sort of halfway mad at all times, right? So that approach, which can in fact work in business, but it's also, I suppose, maybe sometimes dangerous, can really work. And also there's a really interesting research report out not too long ago, ironically from Oracle, about humor and some really compelling stats. I don't have them at my fingertips, about how effective humor can be in B2B content as sort of an operating system. It was really, really interesting stuff.
Well, but I think that's another one of those risks things, like what kind of humor?
Yeah, you got, you know, you're right about that, because you know, people's senses of humor tend to vary dramatically. And so you always have to kind of road test that, maybe with a cross-section of employees or maybe your customer council if you have one, et cetera.
Okay, you bring up a really important point when you say road testing. And I'd like to go a little bit deeper on that. So, you know, when you start talking about risks, when you start talking about chances, when you start talking about breaking status quo, doing something new, well, the reality is that that's how you differentiate, right? So let's establish that. That's fact. So then it's, how do I go about that process? Is we don't see many organizations doing, you know, that road testing, split testing and things like that. Maybe you can explain that a little bit.
Yeah, I think partially, and this has been my experience working with, I've probably consulted for 300 B2B companies, more than that probably, almost invariably, they're always behind the curve on their time horizons. Everybody's always busy. Everybody's always rushed. It's always late. Webinars got to get pushed because they couldn't get the landing page done or whatever, right? I don't know why that is, but I can tell you that it's true. And I'm sure most folks tuning in the B2B DM community are nodding vigorously right now. It's not that B2B digital marketers don't know that it's important to test or do an A/B test or any other kind of test before they deploy something. They just don't have the time. They don't have that extra 2-week window in the production cycle to test, revise, and then launch. And I wish I had an antidote for that. But I will tell you, having been in B2B digital marketing literally since it was invented, and before that in direct mail, where A/B testing is incredibly important, it is worth the time, right? If you can somehow carve it out, it will make you a much more effective and successful organization. Now, that said, Jim, when we're talking about humor, you know, you can't be funny by committee. It doesn't work, right? And when we say don't be boring in your B2B marketing, sometimes what that means is some people will not like it. And that's fine. Because if nobody doesn't like it, if everybody's like, it's great, then it's probably actually not that interesting.
That's a fairly good point. And I think that leads into number 4, and we're going to do a recap of all these again at the end once we conclude, is being too slow. You hit on that a little bit. And affects the split testing and A/B testing, road testing, yeah, whatever you want to call it. But if you could elaborate a little bit more on being too slow.
Yeah, I mean, I think perfect is the enemy of progress in B2B too often. Depends on the leadership and the culture of the company, but too often we got to make sure every single element of the campaign is 100% perfect, as opposed to just moving on to the next step, which might give us the time to do some actual testing. So to some degree, I think we're a little too buttoned up in some cases on the B2B side. But also, when you have a customer that's interested, we've got to do a better job in B2B marketing of moving that customer through the consideration cycle. Now, of course, they may have a buying committee. There may be some other steps necessary. But this idea that, like, okay, they came to the webinar, and then a week later, we're going to follow up with an email. And then a week after that, we're going to have a salesperson try and qualify them. And then and this whole process is going to take months and months. Look, if somebody's in the market, like, give them the opportunity to consume information as quickly as possible. Line it up so they can go, yes, 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 yes. A lot of times our own processes and our own kind of triggered campaigns actually slow down the buying process instead of accelerating the buying process. So you almost want to have two different approaches. One, which is somebody who wants to go shoots and ladders as quickly as possible, give them the opportunity to do that. Yes, 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 yes. Set up an appointment right now. Boom, boom, boom. I'm in the market. And then for other folks who have to have more time to be nurtured and think about it, have a parallel campaign and a parallel track for them. But so often, it's just the one follow-up sequence, which can actually be too slow.
You know, you bring up a good point. One of the things that I talk about with clients and what we try to implement in our strategy is what we call relationship funnels. And that is like, okay, what relationship? It's not about the persona thing. It's what relationship am I in with that person, and no, or how do I need to respond? And then part of it would be, you know, where are they? You know, do I have now a group of 20 decision makers in the committee that I need to, you know, have to be incorporated into the process, or what, you know, what do we need to do? I had somebody, for the past couple of years, we've been doing peer roundtables of RevGen, revenue, as well as sales leaders. And somebody gave to me a great framework that I think is really helpful to be able to execute that. And they said they look for somebody that has the 3 V's within an organization. And the V's are voice, visibility, and vote. It's not title, right? So we could have somebody that has all 3 of those V's, which, you know, may not be, you know, a C-suite person, you know, but yet I have an enterprise solution, you know, so how can I enable that person and then incorporate that into that entire relationship and convert, you know, and close the organization, you know, not just that particular person.
Yeah, I think passion is more important than position. If you have somebody in the organization who is super pumped about your solution, they can help get it adopted, even if they don't have the quote unquote title that would necessarily indicate they've got that kind of authority. Conversely, if you've got somebody who is a VP or a C-suite member, but they're kind of blasé about whatever it is you're selling, they're not gonna make sure it happens, right? So I think your responsibility is to get somebody passionate about what you can offer. And that's more critical than them having the idealized right title.
Most definitely. Okay. So I think maybe the accelerant of all of this is probably your number 5, which is not having radical relevancy.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Every single person tuning in, including Jim and myself, we all tell ourselves the same lie. this has been true for 30 years in B2B DM. We all tell ourselves the same lie. And the lie goes like this, Jim. My prospects are just too busy. They just have too much going on. They're too busy to listen to the podcast. They're too busy to watch the video. They're too busy to attend the webinar. They're too busy to read the one sheet. They're too busy to set up a sales appointment. They're too busy to come to the conference. And that's total crap. It's not about that. They're not too busy. If somebody says they're too busy or indicates in some way they're too busy, what that really means, but they don't usually say it like this because they don't want to hurt your feelings, what it really means is that what you've put in front of them is not relevant enough. Now, I know this to be true because if you give a prospective customer the information they desire and you do it in a way that's got some pizzazz and you do it in a format that they like and you do it at the right time in their consideration set, the time necessary to consume that information magically appears. That's how you get 300,000 downloads of a cookbook, right? It magically appears. So it's not about time. It's that if somebody says they're too busy, it's that it's not relevant enough. It's not worth their time. So you have to understand, how can you make your information more relevant, right? So we've talked about it. It's either make it more inherently interesting and different because you're going to take some chances on a creative side. It's make it more specific so it feels like it was created just for them. And the third one is to change the messenger, not just the message. And we touched on this a little bit earlier, Jim, this idea that third parties are so important. B2B use of influencers and influencer marketing in B2B is going to be huge in the next 3 years, as it should be, because industry experts and current customers and prospective customers and previous customers and employees are all manifestly more trusted than content created from the brand. Right message, right messenger.
You know, there was a couple different studies associated with what you're talking about. One was stating that there is so much information that currently exists out there that it is making decisions more difficult for organizations. And they put a number on it, like it's 18 or 19% more difficult to make a decision because there's so much information.
Yeah. Paradox of choice. Yep.
So if I start thinking about that from a strategy perspective, with what I'm hearing is I should have essentially an unbranded strategy and a branded strategy. Or is that false thinking?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I necessarily characterize it exactly like that, but yeah, so something along those lines, right? Where it's more a set of information that we create that is owned on our own channels, website, our own YouTube, whatever. And then a whole nother set of information that is about us that we didn't necessarily create, right? So influencers appearing on podcasts and be sponsoring podcasts, you know, other information that exists in industry, watering holes and forums and things like that. So it's almost owned versus earned is probably how I think about it. But yeah, it's definitely two streams.
Got it. Okay, so let's do a quick recap. So we talked about the five silly things that digital marketers do being not creating enough content for current customers, not giving permission to tell a bigger story, B2B doesn't stand for boring to boring, being too slow, and then not having radical relevancy. All right, so those are the silly things, but I would dare to say, as we've been talking also even prior to you even coming and joining us today, is that you're probably sitting there and saying, you know what, there's some things and just please goodness to be stop doing these things now. Are there a couple of things that stand out in that category?
I mean, look, here we are 30 years since domain names are free, and I still personally get no fewer than 10 to 12 unsolicited cold emails a day from B2B people trying to sell me something. That's not going to work. Like it doesn't, we got it. Let's reread permission marketing from Seth Godin from 25 years ago and realize that just firing off cold emails is probably not going to make it happen these days. That is pretty annoying. And then I would also say that a lot of times, look, B2B marketing is hard. If it was easy, we wouldn't have a podcast. is hard. And too often, I think we get seduced by the siren song of technology. We think, well, if we just have this package, if we just have this software, if we just have this tool or this add-on, we'll be able to achieve all of our B2B marketing and larger rev gen goals. And there's certainly a time and a place for B2B sales tech and B2B MarTech. There's some amazing tools out there. But I'm telling you that success in this endeavor is about the wizard, not about the wand. If you think that technology is what's going to make you a good B2B digital marketer, it's not. It's what you understand about human behavior and what you understand about your current customers and what you can learn from them to go find other people who think similarly. The technology just helps you do it, but the technology is no replacement for being a good marketer.
Well, with you saying that, it leads me to something that right now is a very hot topic. It's getting a lot of attention. And people talk about intent data, right? Hey, I need to go after the people who are looking for the solution that we have to offer. And I need to find that data. And then therefore now I need to do some types of campaigns or whatever it may be, you know, to try to get their attention. And there was a study that came out that talked about intent data. And it talked about attempts to connect with somebody who is essentially looking for this type of solution. And they're saying without intent data, it takes about 18 attempts to really make contact. And if you have intent data, it takes 17. It's like, okay, I saved one contact attempt. What would you say to that data?
Well, it doesn't surprise me at all. I've always been a big proponent of flypaper, right? Of let's create interesting content that gets people to raise their hand, that gets people to participate and say, yes, I want to hear more from you, as opposed to let's go out and try and tell people what we have cold. So, you know, as somebody who's inherently a content marketer, more so than a direct marketer to cold prospects, it does surprise me. And I think there's a better way. I think there's another way to go. Now, neither are inherently superior, but I do feel like you can win more business by giving people something they want that's beyond just we have a thing to sell you.
Well, with that being said, you know, we talked about data through our discussion in a couple different places, but you actually have some data that you were going to share with us.
Yeah.
So if you could please go ahead and do that.
Of course. Yeah, I have a brand new research report called The Time to Win, and it's all about the relationship between responsiveness and revenue, how critical it is to be fast, especially in the sales and customer service capacity when you're interacting with customers and prospective customers. It's the most comprehensive research of its kind ever undertaken. Many, many thousands of participants. It's definitely high level, university level research. Margin of error is very, very small. And it really shows how critically important it is to be fast. Certainly when customers are in the market, but even when they've been a customer for a while and they have any kind of problem or service. So this research is now being put into practice in lots and lots of organizations all around the United States in particular. The full report's 29 pages. There's infographics, there's video accompaniment as well, a whole bunch of key findings and stats that you can use in your own organization. This is something that you definitely want to give to head of sales and definitely head of customer service, customer experience. You can get it at thetimetowin.com, thetimetowin.com.
And we'll definitely make sure we also have a link to that on your show notes page.
Thanks so much.
I think you also, I want to kind of, you know, focus in on something you said in regards to that. You talked about in market, right? Well, we do know when you start talking about very complex problems that people are attempting to solve, they're not necessarily in market. And studies show that talking about that in market number, depending on what your solution is, it may be as little as 1%.
Yeah.
Entire market opportunity. So, yeah. I mean, how do I, you know, really address that issue? That the bigger opportunity is not that in market. Matter of fact, if I wait to that in market moment, my competition meter is freaking cranked up. Now I have an issue, right?
Yeah, I think part of it is to do two things we already touched on. One is to create content that tells a bigger story, to build an initial relationship with prospective customers before they maybe even know what you do, right? I mean, you think about ActiveCampaign, a lot of people downloaded the recipes because I created a recipe and Ann Hanley created a recipe and other people they had heard of created a recipe. They didn't even know what ActiveCampaign does. But eventually they did. And they're like, oh, that's pretty cool. Maybe we should buy that, right? So to some degree, you can build a relationship before they even know what products and services you offer if you give yourself permission to do that. Second thing is when you're doing your top of the funnel content, don't talk about you. Talk about what problem you solve, right? Focus on the problem, not on the solution, because much more people will be searching and thinking about, man, my life would be a lot better if this was fixed, than they will be looking for your product or your specific kind of thing that you guys call it in your company. So again, it's you touched on this, Jim, talking less about specificity and brand, et cetera, till you get a little further down the funnel, till they're in market, will absolutely help. It sounds so controversial to say that, but it's not. but a lot of companies, they're like, we're not going to spend, you know, we have limited marketing budget, especially in 2023, so we're not going to create anything that isn't about product. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. And that is the craziest thing to say. It's the worst possible approach, right? When the market is tight, you don't pull back and tell more specific stories. You get bigger and tell bigger stories. But I don't know. Like,
well, I think what you just said is they make their own self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Yeah, right. No, that and then they look at the data and say, see? I'm like, well, exactly. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
We'll be having the same conversation in 30 more years, unfortunately. I'll be 83 years old on the show, and I'll be like, look, tell a bigger story. It's okay. Have courage. Don't have to be boring.
Well, and much of what we were talking about, we've mentioned relationships multiple times. You know,
yeah.
We talked about, you know, how do we actually get radical relevancy? Mm-hmm. And it's not in features and benefits. That
no.
Later, when the brand becomes important, features and benefits come important. For me, I want to go after the, and I wouldn't even say the 99%. You know, I don't want to battle it out in a bloody ocean. You know, I want to be able to create that relationship so that when the time comes, I never actually have to play around with the bloody ocean because I become the one where like, you know what? We already know you. I trust you, and then therefore, you know, come fix this for us.
Yep, completely agree. Now that requires, having an organization that has some patience, right? And understands that relationships don't typically happen overnight, and some organizations are kind of set up that way culturally, and others are like, well, you know, how many leads do we have this week? It's like, well, that might be the wrong metric.
So all of this, you made a statement that said, you know, over the next 3 years, the whole influencer market is going to, you know, grow even greater than where it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give a little bit more detail on that?
Sure. I mean, as we talked about, the reality is, and there's lots of data to back this up, that we trust people more than we trust companies, full stop. And we certainly trust people who have real world experience with whatever product or service we're considering. And so your current customers are your best marketers. They just are, right? And so the more that you can turn customers into influencers, I think that's a fantastic approach for most B2B companies, right? Go find customers who are truly passionate and knowledgeable about your solution and then help them get better known. You know, create a podcast with them, create a conference with their speaker, et cetera. And then, of course, there are existing third parties that have influence in the category. And working with people like that, like Jim and myself, et cetera, can really slingshot awareness and customer retention as well. And a lot of good outcomes there.
Okay. Well, I may not have, if I'm sitting here, I'm maybe with a startup organization. So let's say the founder, you know, created this whiz bang thing.
Yeah.
And therefore he got, you know, two or three of his buddies, you know, mm-hmm. to use it. And those are our only case studies, stories, and those are our, you know, only things that we have from a client perspective. And so now we're going to, you know, try to actually go into this particular market and, you know, hopefully get some more customers and things like that. So that I'm in that startup phase and role.
Yep.
How do I do that?
Yeah, if you don't have a lot of existing customers, then you do want to use sort of third-party influencers. So whatever it is that you are selling, there are no doubt somebody's out there who have a magazine column or a podcast or a YouTube channel or an Instagram account or a LinkedIn newsletter or a whatever. Find the folks who are in that category who create content that is trusted and authoritative to your customers. So what you're looking for is the person who influences your customer, right? That's the goal. And you say, look, well, we would like to work together on a way for you to create more content that's trusted and authoritative and awesome over a period of time, right? The biggest mistake people make in the influencer game is they make it transactional. They say, here's $1,000, make me a LinkedIn post, right? Which will work 0% of the time. It has to be a relationship, right? You want a small number of people who are really legit, who don't necessarily have to have a big audience. They just have to be trusted because the audience will grow if the content's good. And you work with them over a long period of time, right? So you want a small number of people that you really believe in and you grow together and it can really work. And then eventually, when you've got more actual customers, then you try and put some lift under them as well, right? Because again, real people telling real stories, even if they're not 1,000% positive, like here's what I didn't like about the solution, can be more effective than a video from the company that says how great it is.
Most definitely. Okay, so I'm sitting here, and Jay Baer, 6 books, keynote speaking, you know, founded and sold agencies, done all this work with a lot of these different organizations. I'm sitting here and saying, okay, well, what's one of Jay Baer's goals?
Personally, I am really excited about my side hustle, my tequila business. I've been interested in agave spirits for 25 years, and about a year ago said, hey, I stopped doing my own podcast. I had a podcast that we ran 600 episodes called Social Pros, all about enterprise social media marketing. And I stopped doing that show, and I said, it's still out there. It's a great show. I'm just not on the microphone anymore. I said, okay, I'm going to take the time I used to spend on my podcast, and I'm just going to make some videos about tequila to educate my friends and other people who don't know anything about tequila. And so I did, and it became a whole thing. And now I have hundreds of thousands of followers on my tequila videos on Instagram and TikTok, and I'm starting my own tequila brand, and all kinds of other stuff is happening there. So in addition to my regular day job, I'm excited about that this year.
Well, we wish you the very best on that. And there's someone else I'm going to share with you. There's a gentleman who I interviewed who wrote this book called Driving Eureka. Very simple name, Doug Hall.
Doug Hall, sure.
You know Doug?
Of course.
Yes. Well, he started the Eureka Ranch. Yes. It was innovation think tank. He's one of the
amazing
and innovation thinkers in the world. But now, what he decided that he wants to do the most is create designer bourbons.
Yep. Tell you what. The water's warm. Jump on in.
Jay Baer, I appreciate you sharing your time with us today and these insights. And again, these are the 5 silly things that digital marketers do. We also covered a lot of more information, including you being able to get insights on that research that Jay was talking about. But Jay, how does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
2 good ways, jaybaer.com, jaybaer.com is my main website. Of course, I'm all over LinkedIn. And then I've got a newsletter that comes out every 2 weeks called The Baer Facts, which has lots of B2B advice, book reviews, podcast reviews, even an occasional tequila review. You can get that at thebaerfacts.com.
Jay Baer, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom, and we wish you the very best.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.